Hey, welcome back. I'll be sitting in the Coast to Coast air chair again tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM, and I'll be joined by cult researcher and advocate for cult survivors, Veni Kosis. She'll join me in the first half to share her harrowing first-person account of her ordeal inside the isolated commune of an ultra-fundamentalist religious cult. In the second half, we'll speak with Hugh Ross, president of Reasons to Believe, an organization thoroughly or dedicated to integrating scientific fact and biblical faith. And the more thoroughly researchers investigate the history of our planet, the more, he says, astonishing the story of our existence becomes. He'll ponder whether our lives are just the result of innumerable coincidences or if there is another explanation. That's Sunday night into Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM. Back with more of my conversation with Forrest Merriti, author of The Autism Vaccine, when Coast to Coast AM continues. Forrest Merriti stays with us, the author of The Autism Vaccine, the story of modern medicine's greatest tragedy. And it is it's really an historical overview of the development of vaccines and the addition of aluminum to certain vaccines. And the onset of what can only be described as an epidemic of autism beginning in the 1930s. We were talking about the Dionne quintuplets that were born in 1934 up here in Canada. And their doctor, Dr. Defoe, was enlisted really to promote the use of the vaccine because he was so well known and so trusted. Does that mean that the Dionne quintuplets were possibly among the first children to receive this diphtheria vaccine precipitated with aluminum?
Yeah, they publicly, for sure, there were a few tests done in the 1930s to some children in Ireland. I don't know if you remember a few years ago hearing stories about an orphanage in Ireland where hundreds of children's bodies were found in a septic tank in the back of the orphanage, and there began to be some horrible stories emerge out of that research that this vaccine, the aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine, was actually being tested at orphanages in Ireland, and people began to become concerned that that's where those dead children came from, and I don't think that's actually the case. But publicly, at least, Dr. Defoe, as you mentioned, was a very famous doctor because he had successfully raised the Dionne quintuplets and saw them through the first couple of years of their life. And he appeared in the papers, you know, with the girls getting their new aluminum-containing diphtheria shot. And it worked. It was a big PR coup. Parents saw it. Everyone was familiar with the Dionne quintuplets. I mean, they met with royalty. They had Hollywood celebrities driving up all the way into Canada to see them. And when parents saw these five girls, you know, their most precious five girls on the planet, getting the aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine, it worked. And parents started to get their children the shot. And unfortunately, Dr. Lee O'Connor at the Baltimore Johns Hopkins Clinic started to see more children with what would later be called autism show up in his at his practice.
Did any of the Dionne quintuplets develop any adverse effects, do we know, from possibly from the vaccine?
Yeah. Now, this is all pure speculation, but two of the girls, Marie and Emily, seemed to have some changes after the shot. Emily, for sure, but Marie, you can even see an article in the newspaper. She had developed crossed eyes. One of her eyes turned inwards, which is something, facial asymmetry is something I do a lot of study on, cranial nerve damage, brainstem injury. And Marie's eye turned in, which is what I consider one of the hallmark signs of brainstem injury. Emily fared much worse. She began to have what were politely called fainting spells, but we now know were probably seizures, or what they would call absence seizures. And basically the precursor of what would later become full-blown epilepsy. And Emily also developed some other quirky behaviors, I'll call them, that I personally believe would land her with an autism diagnosis. She would collect things. She was very into arranging and collecting things. Her sisters describe her as developing an aloneness to herself. And I've actually found some footage of the Dion Quints, where one of them is rocking and spinning. And from what I can tell, I believe it is Emily. And for any of your listeners who have children with autism, they'll recognize those two behaviors right away. The self-soothing rocking motion of a child with maybe dealing with some pain, and the spinning, which is a kind of stemming, self-stimulation behavior. So, yeah, I believe I would describe Emily as on the spectrum from what I've read of her. Now, it's not for me to make a diagnosis on someone, of course, but from what I could tell, Emily and Marie definitely were affected. Now, the real interesting part about the book, the research I was able to uncover, which really begins to make what I believe a compelling case for how this initial addition of aluminum was the beginning of what I call the epidemic of autism, is another country was also experiencing diphtheria outbreaks. And they had nationwide campaigns like the United States to deal with it. In the United States, this was really the first immunization campaign that had corporate money behind it. There was this thing called the Milbank Fund, and some other corporate insurance companies had thrown hundreds of thousands of dollars into raising awareness about the shot. This is the first time mass immunization like this had ever really been undertaken. But there was another country that did a similar thing, and that was Austria. And in Austria, around the same time, they were also experiencing a really bad outbreaks of diphtheria. They started nationwide campaigns to get children vaccinated for it. And unfortunately, they also made the switch to the aluminum-containing version of the shot. Now, for your listeners who don't know this, Leo Kanner in Baltimore wasn't the only one to notice autism, you know, a year or two after this change was made. There was another doctor, his name is Hans Asperger, who was a psychiatrist in Vienna, Austria, and he started having children show up in his clinic with these same symptoms. You know, parents were stumped. They couldn't figure out why their children were not responding to them, what made them live in this sort of isolation, and what made them so obsessed with pattern and ritual. And the children Hans Asperger described, which actually ended up being about 200 of them, were very similar, and now we know they were the same thing, as the children that Dr. Leo Kanner described. So when you look historically at the fact that this change was made in 1932, aluminum being added to the one vaccine that children received at that time, smallpox was a very rare shot. It did exist, but people only got it if there was an outbreak. It wasn't a routine shot like diphtheria became. But in the United States in 1932, when aluminum was added to the vaccine, you see children with autism start to appear directly after that. Once again, the psychiatrist who saw these children had never seen it before, and he wrote a 500-page book on childhood psychiatric disorders, and he didn't even mention it. It was so rare, he didn't mention it after he had seen it. But in Austria, the same thing happens. They have a nationwide diphtheria campaign. They make the change to aluminum, and a psychiatrist there starts to see children show up in his office.
Now, there were a number of interesting theories as to what might have caused not only autism, but mental disorders in general. One of them, they believed it was hereditary. But autism was different because it didn't exactly fit that narrative. Explain why.
Yeah, it's, you know, we have a lot of sort of wasted research money now looking into genetic causes of autism. And most people don't know this, but initially that was the assumption, was that autism was genetic. But the reason why is interesting. It was because the parents were so similar. Back then, mental illness was assumed to be hereditary. All mental illness was assumed to be hereditary. And the parents of these children were almost exclusively intelligent, professional parents. Even the mothers, you know, back then, a college-educated mother was not a frequent occurrence. You know, this was kind of rare back then. But the mothers of these children were extremely educated, extremely intelligent. Their fathers were doctors, attorneys, scientists even. The mothers, some of them psychologists, some of them worked in labs. It was a stunning coincidence that the parents of these children were all so professional and sort of overachievers, if you could call them that. So, yeah, they did initially think that somehow maybe there was some genetic component to it because the parents were so similar. Now, one of the other things a lot of people don't know is one of the hallmark defining characteristics of autism early on that befuddled those who studied it was some of these children began to get better. And for most neurological illness of that era, it was all decay. It was all degenerative. You know, once you started showing signs of dementia, it was a long, steady decline, you know, into the abyss. But for a lot of these children, they were getting better. Not all of them, but some of them, in fact, I would say the majority of them, were showing some kind of progress after some initial regression event. And that really confused them. They had never seen that before. Because back then, if you started showing signs of dementia, you know, it was over. It was going to take a while, maybe. It might take longer than shorter, but you would eventually die from it. These children had what amounted to be some injury, if you could call it that, and I certainly would, and they healed from it. Now, not totally and not always, but that one characteristic was so confusing to those who studied it. It was just yet another sign that this was something new they had never seen before. So the initial study of looking for a genetic cause is interesting because it came out of the fact that the parents of these children were so uniformly intelligent, professional, academic type people that they assumed there had to be some link to it.
And well, do you think...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask if you think that that link might be because these were educated people, because they read newspapers, maybe they even read medical journals, they were more likely to vaccinate their children with this aluminum precipitated diphtheria vaccine. Is that the connection?
Yeah, for sure. That's what it is. And you see it today. You know, today, if you look at the people who are not vaccinating their children, many of them are educated, affluent professionals. You can see this written about all the time. You know, the anti-vaxxers of Los Angeles, you know, they live in Bel Air and they go to, you know, the private schools. They go to the Montessori schools. So I would assume that educated parents, particularly mothers, are ahead of the curve. They're looking at the latest research. And back then, the latest research said, get the new shot and your children will not have to worry about A, diphtheria, and they won't have to worry about allergic reactions to the shot. So I think you're exactly right. These were intelligent parents who cared for their children like all parents do, and they thought they were doing the right thing. And you see it today in that educated, affluent parents today are usually the ones who are questioning vaccines more because they've been doing the research. So these people, their colleagues worked in science, their colleagues worked in medicine, their colleagues told them their children should have these shots and that there was a new version of the shot that wasn't that was going to work better, that they might only need one. And I assume that that's exactly what happened. That's why these were the ones that initially got the shot.
After diphtheria, there are new vaccines. There's one for tetanus or lockjaw. There's one for the whooping cough, also known as pertussis. They were all sort of bundled together with the diphtheria vaccine. Did they all contain aluminum as well?
Yeah, those three. Tetanus was added in 1938, 1939, and pertussis or whooping cough was added in 1942. And it's a far cry from the, you know, 100 or 200 injections children receive today. That's an overstatement. But back then, parents weren't afraid of tetanus, and nobody wanted their children to get additional injections. You know, injections were considered so strange and terrifying of a medical procedure that when they came out with a tetanus shot, a tetanus vaccine, no one cared. No one wanted it. And in fact, Dr. Defoe, the quintuplets doctor, said he had never seen a case of tetanus in his whole life. So what they did was they combined it into the diphtheria injection so that you could get protection from two diseases with only one injection. Now, they also did the same thing in 1942 with the whooping cough vaccine. They added it. So it ends up being a triple shot. Now, remember, when I first mentioned, it was initially supposed to be one shot. That was the promise of adding aluminum. But they discovered, even with the addition of aluminum, the shot didn't work very well. So it ended up being three shots. And as you know today, if you have children, it's now five shots. And there's talk of adding a sixth. So diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis were the original three in that single injection most children received three times. They all contained aluminum, but even so, autism as we now know it was still very rare. It was a rare occurrence, one in 10,000, they would say, even up into the 60s or 70s. It was only later that the rates really began to skyrocket.
And we'll delve into, you know, when autism really took off, and why that was exactly. We're heading into a break, but I want to, when we come back, I also want to talk to you about aluminum and its effect on the body. And I mean, we are talking about micrograms. We're not talking about even milligrams of aluminum in a vaccine. So one might genuinely ask, you know, how is it possible that a microgram of aluminum could cause something like autism? How could it severely injure the brain stem? We'll do that on the other side. My guest is Forrest Merede, the author of The Autism Vaccine, The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy. And we will also open up the phone lines at the top of the hour. We'll take your questions and comments. And I would particularly like to hear from the medical community. If you're a doctor, perhaps there's a question I'm not asking that I should be asking. I would invite you to call. And if you'd like to challenge Forrest Merede and his findings, you're welcome to do so. Now, taking us into the break, here's Warren Zevon, Lawyers, Guns, and Money on Coast to Coast AM. If you like what you're hearing tonight, this morning, why not check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, which airs out of Toronto, Canada, on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. For more information, you can go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, and you can find a list of affiliates there. Find a radio station near you. Also, I'd encourage you to check out my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can listen and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Forrest Merede, the author of The Autism Vaccine, the story of modern medicine's greatest tragedy, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Forrest, I'm guessing that the medical community, the scientific community, would argue that the levels of aluminum present in vaccines is so minimal that it couldn't possibly have any negative effect. It's almost inert, right? We're talking about micrograms here. How is it possible for aluminum that at trace levels to be so injurious to our health?
Well, the main reason is the aluminum in vaccines, and it's important to know it's not this silvery liquid substance, the white powder. It gets picked up by your white blood cells, and in your immune system, your white blood cells are the defenders. You know, they attempt to gobble up dangerous microbes, and when your body gets aluminum in it, your white blood cells surround the aluminum, but they can't destroy it. And these white blood cells, it's important to know, they don't freely roam around your body, but they go in your body where your immune system signals for help. So when you get an injection from a vaccine, there's a couple of things that happen that trigger signaling for these white blood cells. And unfortunately, all of the signaling is comes from your brainstem, which is where I believe the heart of autism injury occurs. So when you get a cut anywhere on your body, your body sends white blood cells to that cut. It makes sense. You know, it's trying to keep an infection from happening from the cut. But what's interesting is your brain itself also signals for help from white blood cells. And we don't know why this is, but it makes for a pretty good design in that if you're injured, your body is sort of proactively sending extra white blood cells to your brain to ensure that nothing happens. So when you get a cut, your body sends white blood cells to the cut, and your brain also asks for white blood cells to come to its aid. And the same thing happens when you get an infection. If your body senses a microbial infection from a virus or bacteria, your brain signals for help from white blood cells. Now, unfortunately, if you're getting a vaccine that contains aluminum in it, those white blood cells that are being summoned to your brain from the tissue injury of an injection itself and from a microbial invasion from within the vaccine, unfortunately, that aluminum is going to end up being signaled to your brain, the brain stem specifically, the heart of what I consider to be the autism injury. So there's a third component, which I talk about in the book, and in fact, I talk about in my other book, Crooked, which is fear. And the human body's reaction to fear, everyone's heard of this, is called the fight or flight reaction, where, you know, all sorts of biological changes happen to prepare your body for fighting or fleeing. This is why a lot of people have an upset stomach. You know, if you get really threatened by something, this is why possums play dead when they get very afraid. They go into a complete shutdown, and this is called, you know, they call it playing dead, but the possum isn't pretending to be dead. Their body actually literally shuts down. So in humans, we also have that same reaction to fear that is really triggered when fight or flight options don't appear to exist. And this is a part of what's called polyvagal theory, which is an attempt to explain the body's response to stress. And stress is very severe in the human body when you're being immobilized or restrained. And this is actually how stress is induced in animal models in a lab. This is how they purposely induce stress, is they immobilize and restrain an animal. It creates an incredible amount of stress. So for children who are, you know, let's say around 12 to 18 months old and are about to receive a vaccine or multiple vaccines, it's not hard to imagine that a lot of restraint and immobilization is required to pen these children down. When that happens, their brainstem signals out to white blood cells that it needs help. And like I said, unfortunately, after vaccination, those white blood cells are likely to contain aluminum in them. And aluminum is a neurotoxin. It is a, they didn't know it at the time, of course, when they first started adding it into vaccines. They had been using it to help filter out water supply. So it's like, you know, how can it be that dangerous? But we now know it's a horrible, dangerous neurotoxin. But the argument, as you mentioned, when we came out of the break, is doctors have always insisted the dosage is so low, it couldn't possibly harm. The reality is the dosage doesn't need to be very high at all, because a lot of the aluminum that gets injected via through vaccination is going to get picked up by white blood cells. And because of the idiosyncrasies of vaccination itself, which are, one, tissue injury, you know, you're getting injected with something, you're getting stabbed with something, you're getting a microbial invader. And for a lot of children, there's a lot of immobilization and restraint required. These three things cause aggressive signaling for help into the brainstem from white blood cells. And these white blood cells, after an injection of aluminum-containing vaccine, are going to contain aluminum. So the brainstem, it's important to know this. The brainstem is not like the rest of the brain. You know, you've seen these crazy stories of people, you know, getting a javelin through their brain and waking up and being able to speak a new language and, you know, sort of being no worse for the wear despite a horrible brain injury. The brainstem, which is the part that connects, it comes out of the bottom of the brain and connects it to the spinal cord. The brain stem is not that way. It doesn't have that plasticity. A tiny, tiny little injury there will show up in all kinds of places. So the amount of aluminum that's contained in any vaccine is not, you know, diluted throughout the body. Like if you can imagine pouring a packet of grape Kool-Aid powder into a pitcher of water, and you can just see it sort of, you know, spreading out evenly to turn the entire water a different color. That's not what happens with the aluminum vaccines. It's almost like a targeted missile strike. The body picks up that aluminum in the white blood cells, and because of the idiosyncrasies of the way vaccines are administered, particularly the fear that comes from immobilization and restraint, that's going to drive that aluminum into the brainstem. And that's why tiny, tiny amounts of aluminum are able to reach the brainstem and cause so much damage. Now, thankfully, so it's like it is rare. We all know that, but it does happen.
So it's like a Trojan horse, in other words, because the white blood cells would normally go to the brain, but this time they're carrying the aluminum, which are sort of piggybacking, and then otherwise they would never be able to get past the blood-brain barrier had they not attached themselves to the white blood cell.
Yeah, your brain has a barrier that protects toxins from sort of getting outside of the blood vessels into the brain. But white blood cells get a free pass because they're considered, you know, part of the team. They're the guardians. And when the aluminum is inside, the Trojan horse metaphor couldn't be more appropriate, because now the aluminum can sort of freely pass around the brain. And that was always, you know, one of the arguments is, how are these metals getting past the blood-brain barrier? Well, now we know. It appears that they're getting past because they're hitching a ride inside the white blood cells.
Why does autism affect mostly boys?
Yeah, it's unknown, but I have a hypothesis as to why that is. And it actually has to do with the stress response that I was just mentioning. Females have a very different response to stress than males. It's the single biggest gender differentiator besides pregnancy and childbirth. And when females undergo extreme stress, they start producing a hormone called oxytocin, which they call the cuddle hormone. It's, you know, it's a pain relief and bonding sort of effect. And, you know, you can see this in stories throughout history of women who've been kidnapped and seeing stories of them bonding with their attacker and eventually their attacker releasing them. And it's a crazy phenomenon that may explain a lot, actually, when women are assaulted. You hear horrible stories of women saying they couldn't fight back, and people say, why couldn't you fight back? And they just don't understand why some women weren't able to fight back. And female response to stress is just different than the male response. This is, you know, objectively been studied in a lot of different research. And my opinion is when girls are vaccinated at an age that requires immobilization and restraint, their brain doesn't signal for help from white blood cells as aggressively as boys. People for years have always attributed it to, you know, the differences between estrogen and testosterone. But if you look at the amount of those hormones in girls and boys at that age, they're nearly identical. I mean, there's almost no testosterone or estrogen difference in boys and girls at that age. So for me, it has to be something different. It's not testosterone or estrogen that have anything to do with why girls seem to be less susceptible to neurological injury after vaccination. I believe it's because the stress response is so different between males and females. And in fact, you can see this even in Parkinson's disease, which is another brainstem injury. Parkinson's originates from a part of the brainstem called the substantia nigra, which is responsible for dopamine production. And men have a higher prevalence for it because it happens in the brainstem. And my sort of one of my overarching hypotheses is any brainstem specific neurological injury is always going to have a higher rate of males than females because of the stress response difference. And interestingly, you might like this, Richard, smoking is actually a way to reduce your risk of Parkinson's. And you might ask, why is that? Well, smoking is a relaxing activity for a lot of people. It lowers their anxiety. It lowers their stress. And in fact, smoking has been shown to lower the production of this thing called MCP1, which is a signaling hormone for white blood cells. So if you smoke, you're not as stressed. And they've actually measured this in the brainstem. Your brainstem doesn't signal for help from white blood cells as aggressively, which is why I believe smoking is a way of reducing risk for Parkinson's. You're basically a little more relaxed than someone else. So it's a fascinating phenomenon, but you see it. Any neurological injury that is not specific to the brainstem has a nearly even dispersion of female and male. Any brainstem specific neurological disorder will usually favor males. And I believe it's because the stress response is so different between the genders.
You mentioned earlier that while aluminum, potassium aluminum and aluminum hydroxide had been added to vaccines in the 1930s and then increased in the 1940s with the addition of tetanus and pertussis, the autism rate really didn't start to escalate until the 1970s and 1980s. What changed?
Yeah, of course, in the 1970s is when you see the measles vaccine come online. And later throughout that decade, they add the mumps and the rubella, and it becomes a combo shot called the MMR shot. And the MMR, which everyone knows has sort of been associated with autism by parents, not by epidemiologists, but by parents, the measles component of that vaccine, and in fact all of them, but the measles is particularly nasty, is capable of causing encephalitis. And encephalitis is swelling of the brain. And we all know, if you studied the scientific literature, that encephalitis is capable of causing some of the symptoms of autism. Now, fortunately, most children who get encephalitis from either a natural measles infection or from the vaccine itself are able to clear that infection and get over it. But one of the other sort of nasty problems with aluminum is its association with autoimmune disease. And, in 1932, the year aluminum was added to the first childhood vaccine, was the same year a scientist named Burl Bernard Crone defined sort of a new disorder that they called Crohn's disease, which was this chronic long-running infection in the intestine that the body couldn't clear. And as I mentioned, the measles vaccine itself is certainly capable of creating encephalitis in children, which we know can cause the symptoms of autism. But when that child also has aluminum in their body from a previous injection, or let's say they get another injection the same day, that aluminum appears to be capable of turning what would be a self-limiting infection into an autoimmune infection. And that's what we call autoimmune encephalitis. And autoimmune encephalitis doesn't go away. Your body has a much harder time clearing it. And that's why I believe autism initially started to really pick up in the 70s and 80s is the combination of measles or any of the components of the MMR vaccine really causing encephalitis. But with the addition of aluminum from other aluminum-containing shots, it has the ability to turn it into autoimmune encephalitis, which is a long-running encephalitis that will cause autism, the effects of autism, and is not so easily dispersed by the body's immune system. And interestingly, if I may just mention this really quickly, all of the gut issues that everyone associates with autism today were really never mentioned early on until the MMR vaccine. You can go through, and I bought about every autism book there was through the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, and you just don't ever see gut issues mentioned as a comorbidity of autism, whereas nowadays it's just accepted as common fact that a lot of children with autism also have debilitating gut disorders. So I think the MMR vaccine certainly has a significant part in developing these intestinal problems that we see with autism. And of course, after the 1970s, into the 90s and 2000s, once indemnity was removed from vaccine manufacturers, there was a thing called the National Vaccine, a Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, I think that's the right acronym. In 1986, it removed all indemnity. Vaccine manufacturers couldn't be sued for the problems their pediatric vaccines caused. And you start to see the introduction of loads of new pediatric vaccines.
All right, we'll take a quick time out for us. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines and take questions and comments for Forrest Merriti. And I encourage those in the medical community to call in with your questions as well. Here's Little Richard. I don't want to discuss it on Coast to Coast AM.